The Legal Sunday, the Historical Aspect of the Question, Chapter 4. The Plymouth Brownists, who set up an established church and the Sunday law in America. Origin and character of the Brownist sect. Their treason in England. Their departure from England and from Holland altogether, voluntary. Their freedom in Holland, except in the matter of bullying the Dutch. They came to America as fugitives from nothing, but to make money out of the fisheries, and to set up an established church of their own. It has been said that the importance attached to the compulsion of belief led to the elaboration of the complex creeds now recognized among Christians. It also led to the multiplication of sects. Strong-minded, zealous, earnest men, with their own salvation and that of their fellows at stake, could not be kept, even by fire and sword, from pondering over matters of faith and announcing their conclusions. And, apparently, it was impossible to announce any conclusions, however crude or monstrous, without securing enthusiastic disciples eager for the crown of martyrdom. In the multitude of its sectarian divisions, popular Christianity stands peculiar among the religions of the world. And the number of these divisions is still increasing. In the importance which they attach to belief, the Christians of Great Britain were fully abreast of their brethren on the continent. When the English Parliament finally severed the connection of the state church with the See of Rome, 1558, the various shades of religious opinion were almost infinite in number. Elizabeth, who was then made the Pope of the new dispensation, like Henry VIII, looked on the separation as a political rather than a doctrinal movement. There were perhaps no tenets of Rome to which she did not subscribe, except the theory which gave the Roman pontiff the right to meddle with the civil affairs of her kingdom. From her attachment to Rome's gorgeous and stately ceremonial, and her inclination toward the doctrine which it symbolized, to the intense aversion felt by the low church clergy for every particular of Romish service and distinctive dogma, it was a long way. And the intervening ground was filled with men whose views were more or less a compromise between the two extremes. There were a number of lay believers separated in fact, if not in law, from the establishment, before the formal repudiation of Rome's authority by the latter. But, on the other hand, many of very advanced opinions remained in clerical positions. The setting up of the new order of things precipitated a revolt, and undoubtedly helped to bring about the disaster of the reign of Charles I. Many influential clergymen who, if undisturbed, might have lived and died within the fold, having tendered to them an oath of supremacy, that is, an oath which recognized Elizabeth as the governess of the church, gave up their livings and at once assumed the position of martyrs to principle. These were the nonconformists. They formed a most important addition to the forces of discontent. The low churchmen, who remained in nominal connection with the establishment, while more or less openly repudiating some of its doctrines, were known by the general name of Puritans, one, or the pure, a name they gave themselves in the true spirit of the Pharisee, thanking God they were not as other men. Yet there was in the early days of Puritanism something about it attractive to the earnest one. The Puritan sect, properly so called, was a party within the Church of England that objected to the cross in baptism, the ring in marriage, the use of the surplice, and the bowing at the name of Jesus. Hume's Hist of England, Volume 4, page 228. Minded. It appeared a revolt against formalism, an appeal to conduct rather than ritual as the real business of religion. It was a reaction, timely and serviceable, from the frivolity and inconsequence of the day. But it seems to be the fate of those who attack forms as such to end by becoming themselves the slaves of forms, only of another sort. Witness the case of Fox and his Quakers. Witness the Puritans who drifted into Brownism. 1. It cannot be too often repeated and emphasized that herein lay the radical distinction between Puritanism proper and Brownism, that Puritanism was, in its essence, a lawful, legitimate movement within the Church of England for the simplification of doctrine and especially of ceremonial, whereas the cornerstone of Brownism was separation, or the setting up of a new church, and this as a mere first step toward the destruction of the establishment, then, as now, an integral part of the British Constitution. Nor, as will presently appear, had the Brownists any idea of stopping at this point. Having destroyed the English Church and set up a new organization in its place, they next proposed to destroy the government and erect a new and wholly ecclesiastical polity upon its ruins. The Brownist sect did not arise until some time after Puritanism, in its larger sense, had become an important factor in the English state. Brown, its founder, was of what is called good family, but of a temper most violent and implacable, and a self-conceit which made him regard every slightest utterance of his own as a direct emanation from deity. His domineering spirit would brook no contradiction or interference, and constantly found expression in acts of violence. He habitually beat his wife, though he was careful to explain that he beat her not as his wife, but as an accursed old woman. About 1550, he began to preach a separation of the church from the state and an independence of secular authority. He does not appear to have objected to the doctrines, but merely to the forms of the English church. Here, again, he expressed the essence of Puritanism. Pharisaical sanctity is always accompanied by an overweening regard for externals. To cleanse the outside of the platter has from the beginning been the great objective point of Puritan morality. Brown went from England of his own free will and established himself with a small congregation in the island of Zealand. But not even the Brownists could stand Brown. His uncontrollable violence and tyrannical egotism broke up his church as it would have done any church or government with which it was strong enough to cope. He returned to England and sold his birthright to the enemy for a mess of pottage, that is to say, he conformed and accepted a rectorship under the Church of England. The position was a sinecure. He had a curate to do the work while he enjoyed the living. From our standpoint, his case was not so bad as it was from his own. As has been said, he had never found any fault with Anglican doctrines, so that there is no ground for charging him with sale of conscience on such points. But we must remember that Brown made points of conscience out of mere ceremonial practices, and these he undeniably bartered away. True, he boasted that there was but one church in England, and that was his church, and the ceremonies therein were of the simplest. But his every utterance shows that his views were unchanged when he accepted the charge at the hands of an organization which enforced the ceremonies he had so bitterly denounced, not, indeed, as matters of faith, but still as things which were excellent and desirable in themselves, and which her priests were pledged to observe on all convenient occasions. So that he did in that acceptance crook the pregnant hinges of the knee where thrift might follow fawning. His violent temper held him till the last. In disputing with a constable about taxes, he proceeded to blows, and afterward outrageously insulted the justice of the peace before whom he was arraigned, and was sent to jail, where he died at the age of 80 years, boasting on his deathbed that he had been in 32 different prisons. We have said that Brown advocated a separation of the church from the state, that is to say, a separation of the English church from the English state. But a separation of church and state was no part of his scheme. On the contrary, he proposed to abandon the episcopal organization and make each congregation altogether independent of the rest, and then to place all the authority of king, parliament, and magistrates in the hands of the rulers of each church. In a word, to overthrow the government of England and substitute, therefore, a number of small hierarchies, wherein there should be not merely a union of church and state, but an absolute identity of the two, modeled after the system of the Jews in Palestine. And pending this reconstruction of the British Constitution, Brown inculcated as a sacred duty forcible resistance to the law of the land. Of course, these theories of Brown's were treason, pure and simple. Neither his apostasy nor his death prevented their spreading. And when we consider the zeitgeist, we are amazed at the leniency with which the advocates of such doctrines and those who applauded them were treated. A great deal has been written and declaimed about the cruelties inflicted upon the Brownists and the oppressions they endured for conscience' sake. But when we come to examine the details, we find no such horrible deeds as those which blot the history of the Brownist Church in America. It was not their freedom to worship God, but their license to advocate the disintegration of the state, which the government, as in duty bound, denied to them. We have seen that, by reason of the identification of church and state, heresy and treason were at all times in danger of being rendered identical. The distinctive point about the case of the Brownists is that they based their treason on their heresy or faith and openly avowed that they were divinely inspired to defy the law and the authorities. That there should be no public worship save that which the state ordained and regulated was a part of the accepted union of church and state. That meetings at which resistance to the state itself was preached as an article of religious faith were proper objects for police interference was taken for granted. Such were the meetings of the Brownists, such were the doctrines they taught. The extent of persecution they suffered was the breaking up of these meetings. Nobody was banished, hung, or mutilated for taking one view of the gospel rather than another, so long as he neither taught nor practiced treason. These meetings were secret and held in private houses. The Brownists were never punished for frequenting other places of worship than those of the established church, because none such existed, and no Protestant sect assumed or pretended to the right of erecting them. Volume 4, page 351. It is certain that at the time of their departure from England, the Brownists had little to complain of. In James I, they were blessed with a sovereign to whom it was only less obnoxious to employ violence than to suffer it. Peaceable, kind-hearted, fond of books, vain of his scholarly attainments, courting a tranquil, easy life. If the Brownists had been content to prate of abstractions or to exercise their freedom to worship God in quietness and peace, it is not thinkable that James would have inflicted any worse punishment on them than to address them a pamphlet explaining the precise delineations between orthodoxy and heterodoxy. It has been well said that had the king been disposed to grant the Puritans a full toleration for a separate exercise of their religion, it is certain, from the spirit of the times, that this sect itself would have despised and hated him for it, and would have reproached him with lukewarmness and indifference to the cause of religion. Page 350. It has been observed that the animosity of the Brownists was directed rather against forms than doctrines. It may be added that, so far as they possessed a definite theology, James I was not likely to find much fault with it. He was strongly inclined toward the Genevan school, of which the milder Puritanism was an outgrowth, and of which Brownism was a closer copy than many Calvinists of our day like to admit. But the Brownists were not men to improve under indulgence. The more license they had, the more reckless and anarchical they grew. Extravagant as the claim seemed to their contemporaries, inadmissible as it may seem even to us, it was by no means sufficient from their standpoint that they should be permitted to be a law unto themselves. It was essential to their scheme of life that they should be a law to all others with whom they were brought in contact. Under the existing state of things, it was impossible that they should be this in England. Nor was it likely that the existing state of things would in the near future be altered favorably in this regard. To all but a few, the doctrines they held were as repulsive as the manners and character of their advocates, which is putting the case very strongly indeed. The time was coming when fanaticism, as deep and relentless as theirs, though tempered with worldly wisdom, was to rule over England. But they would have proven a thorn in the side of Cromwell himself. The strong, centralized organization which he set up would have been as obnoxious to them as the government which he overthrew. And, while, as we shall see hereafter, their leaders were perfectly capable, in this regard as in others, of abandoning their professed principles in the interest of their own aggrandizement, yet Cromwell would have had to confront the alternative of allowing those leaders to rule the Commonwealth and run it, or of being assailed with the same revolutionary invectives which they launched so freely at King and Parliament alike. In short, it may be truthfully said of these Brownists that their principles and practices rendered it absolutely necessary for them to live alone, inasmuch as they could by no possibility live in peace with other men. Brown himself had recognized this fact by leaving England. It was some 30 years later that a second party of his followers determined to imitate his example. John Robinson was at their head. As with the movement led by Brown himself, their leaving was an act of voluntary exile and not in the least the result of banishment or induced by persecution. There is every reason to believe that the kindly-hearted James was sorry to have them go. His subsequent correspondence with them is marked by fatherly regard on his side and hypocritical subserviency on theirs. John Robinson and his people went first to Leiden. They could have their own way in Holland, as they could in England, in their own affairs, just so far as that way was compatible with the preservation of order and the supremacy of law. Further than this, they could not go in either country. The Holland churches were no further removed in doctrine from the Romanists than the low church school of Anglicanism to which James himself belonged. But the Brownists were comparatively safe in Holland from the sight of those ceremonial observances which to hate was with them an essential of religion. Neither hosts nor guests were, however, content with the situation. The Dutch were poor and absolutely set in their ways. The Brownists were avaricious and bent on establishing their theocracy. The stories of the enormous fortunes gained in the fisheries of North America and the opportunity of their realizing their dream of a united church and state led them to determine to remove hither. We shall not wonder that when the Brownists were taught to regard themselves as a chosen people and to liken themselves to the Israelites of old, they remembered that, while the mission of these last was the conservation of the faith, it was a part of their destiny to spoil the Egyptians and to enter the land of the Canaanites and possess it. It was a fundamental article of the Brownist creed that the Brownists were the just, and it was written that the just should inherit the earth. Moreover, those who did not agree with them could not be overcome without the command of material resources. The acquisition of power, therefore, was a sacred duty, in order that the children of Belial might be destroyed and a kingdom of this world erected in the Master's name. The spirit of the early bishops, who effected the first union of the Christian church with the state, was thus working perfectly among the men who set up an established church on American soil. And it is to those men that we owe our American Sunday laws. Every Sunday law in America is the work of this spirit, as was that first Sunday law which Constantine made for Europe.